From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. The first documented case of encephalitis lethargica occurred at the tail end of World War I. A soldier fell ill and eventually looked as if he were asleep, peacefully immobile, statuesque even. But he wasn't asleep or even comatose. The disease simply took away his ability to move, and it was contagious. Nearly 100 years and over a million deaths later, sleeping sickness remains an enigma. Doctors don't know what caused the disease, and there's no known cure. Today on the program, science writer Molly Caldwell-Crosby joins us to piece together what we know and don't know about this forgotten epidemic. That's coming up after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Sleeping sickness gained notice in the U.S. in the 1920s, a mysterious disease that killed over a million people and devastated the lives of those who survived. It was a debilitating and sometimes lethal epidemic, and doctors still don't know the cause. What makes sleeping sickness such a diagnostic puzzle, and could it reemerge with the next flu outbreak? Today on the program, a look at encephalitis lethargica. Joining us on the show, Molly Caldwell-Crosby. She's a science writer whose work has appeared in Newsweek, Health, National Geographic, and USA Today. Her first book, The American Plague, focused on yellow fever, and her latest book is titled Asleep, The Forgotten Epidemic That Remains One of Medicine's Greatest Mysteries. And Molly Crosby joins us from the studios of WKNO in Memphis, Tennessee. Molly Crosby, thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And we invite you to join the conversation with your questions or comments. 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378, or you can send email to radiowest@kuer.org. Molly Caldwell-Crosby, some may remember this disease from the 1973 book Awakenings by Dr. Oliver Sacks. It was turned into a movie in 1990. Why do you call it the forgotten epidemic?
Really, that's the only book that addresses this disease in any large format. And it's a fascinating read if anyone has not read it or seen the movie. I had the privilege of getting to interview Dr. Sacks in the course of researching this book. And he was a young neurologist at the time. He was assigned to a hospital for the chronically ill in New York, and he noticed among all of these patients sitting in the wards, they appeared really catatonic. Most were wheelchair-bound. They could not move or speak or take care of themselves, and it was sort of a mystery. He went through a lot of their medical files trying to piece together what might have happened and realized that all of these patients were survivors of this long-forgotten epidemic 40 years before, during the 1920s, known as sleeping sickness. He, even though this was just the 1960s, he had not even been taught this disease in school. So it really was a mystery to the medical world at the time. And he started researching it further, and he's really the first one who put the pieces of the puzzle together to think that what these patients were actually suffering from, the long-term effects of sleeping sickness, was an extreme form of Parkinson's that had literally just frozen their bodies still. So he decided to test the effects of the new breakthrough drug for Parkinson's at the time, which was L-DOPA, the same we use today. And he was able to awaken a number of these patients, hence the title of his book, Awakenings. And it is a beautiful but also tragic story. He was not able to maintain the levels of L-DOPA to keep these patients in that awake state. They slowly went back to their original kind of trapped form within their own bodies. And it was tragic for them. It was tragic for their family members who got to come and visit with them, see them, talk to them for the first time in 40 years. And even all these years later, when I interviewed him, I could tell that he's still very haunted just by the personal experience of dealing with these patients. So you take his experience and apply it to what so many doctors went through in the 1920s and 30s. And it was just a very haunting disease for everyone.
This is not just a mystery for the history books and medical historians, but one that you have a personal connection with. Tell us about your grandmother, Virginia, and her experience with sleeping sickness.
Sure. I was actually just researching some material on her. She passed away about 10 years ago. And she was never completely normal. She just was always mentally a little bit off and seemed very distracted, kind of lost a little bit. And everyone in the family would say she's just been that way since the sleeping sickness epidemic. So it was something that I grew up hearing about. And the more I looked into it, I was surprised by how widespread it had been and yet how forgotten it had been. I could find very little information on it. And her story actually took place in Dallas, Texas in 1929. This was a worldwide pandemic, so it spread not only within the U.S. but across the world. She was 16 years old at the time. She came down with some of the classic just fever, sore throat kind of symptoms that were usually accompany the onset of this disease. And then she fell asleep for 180 days. She didn't wake. So she was not able to finish high school. Once she did finally wake up again, it's a slow physical recovery. So she was too weak to get out of bed for a few weeks and then was never able to finish school. She did live a relatively normal life. She went on to marry and have children, obviously, but she felt the long-term effects, and we could all feel them through her. She definitely was not a very normal, I would say, happy person, and I'm not even sure how aware of it she was, but it was definitely the long-term effects of this particular disease.
Did she ever talk to you or your parents directly about what that felt like to be immobilized, to be imprisoned in your own body for such an extended period of time? 180 days is a long time.
Yes. No, she did not. Unfortunately, at the time I was, that she was still living, I never really knew I would be writing about this topic or about her. So I would have loved the opportunity to ask her more questions about it. The few questions I asked as a child, she just would usually dismiss them, just sort of say, I was just very tired, I just felt very strange. Based on the interviews with other people who survived sleeping sickness, they were definitely cognizant. They were aware. They were just literally kind of trapped within their own bodies. They could hear, smell. They knew things happening around them. They were even aware of events that had taken place over some of the weeks or months that they were out. But that was probably one of the hardest things for those patients, and one of the saddest things for me in researching it was realizing that these patients were not peacefully asleep. They were not comatose. They were trapped, literally.
Well, what is the difference between sleeping sickness and a coma? Because it does sound, you know, quite similar to the layman.
Yeah, it does. And also, I often get asked about the other sleep disorders, insomnia, narcolepsy, things like that. What was happening with encephalitis lethargica, the brain damage that was taking place was particularly hitting the basal ganglia in the midsection of the brain. When the swelling, which was the main symptom of this disease, took place, it caused damage to that area that caused the acute phases, the acute symptoms, and the long sleep. And then later, that swelling is what caused the damage, either in personality disorders or mental damage or the physical damage that was so prevalent with Parkinson's. The doctor who first identified it, Konstantin von Economo, in 1916, he's best known, he's a neurologist, he's best known for his work with sleep disorders. And he really explained it just that this was completely altering the sleep patterns of the person. While most of these patients did go into this deep sleep, some actually suffered the reverse. They suffered severe insomnia from encephalitis lethargica. That was the minority of the patients, but most of those patients actually died because their bodies gave out after a number of weeks without any sleep. So for this disease, it really was very much related to sleep patterns.
You mentioned that the first documented case occurred in World War I, caught the attention of this Viennese neurologist, von Economo. Mm-hmm. I was surprised to learn that the mortality rate was so high. As many as 40% of his patients with this disease died from it. What did he figure out about the disease, how it spread, how it might have been caused?
Well, interestingly, at the time, he's working at a medical clinic in Vienna. And on the opposite side of the war in Paris, another doctor named Cruchet, they're on opposite sides, so they could not discuss their cases with one another, but they were actually seeing the same cases occurring in their clinics coming off of the battlefields in World War One, and they both published papers on the subject within a week of each other. So for a while, there was some controversy over who actually named this set of symptoms first. It's sometimes referred to as von Economo's encephalitis. He was the one who put this disparate set of symptoms together because it was a very unusual disease, a kaleidoscope of symptoms, not just the sleep, but they started seeing in both of their clinics in Paris and in Vienna a number of hysteria cases. There were a lot of disorders coming in like Tourette's syndrome, OCD, schizophrenia. There was just an upsurge of these unusual neurological tics taking place. There were even cases of hiccuping. One person died of incessant hiccuping. So this very unusual influx of patients is coming in, and the only one thing they have in common is that they keep falling asleep or staying asleep for indefinite periods of time. So von Economo was the first who noticed this sleep connection. He named the disease encephalitis lethargica, which is literally the swelling in the brain that makes you sleepy. Mm. And it would have been beneficial and probably sped along the research of this disease if it had not been taking place right in the midst of a war. So Cruchet and von Economo were not able to work together or compare notes or even warn the public about this disease. So within a year or two, it started showing up in London and then in the U.S.
One distinguishing factor was that it spread. It was infectious. How quickly do we know, do we have any idea how quickly it was spreading?
No, because the war really throws a kink into all of that. All diseases, all epidemics see a major upswing during wars, especially before penicillin, before we had antibiotics, just in general. These soldiers were dying of disease more than they were dying of combat wounds. So you always see a major uptick in the number of diseases. And one of the real mysteries about this disease is it is not itself contagious. It was not spreading from one person to another in a household, although it started with the soldiers. Once it hit London, it started hitting the general public. And once it hit the U.S., it was most definitely hitting the large cities, larger populations. So the mystery both then and now is what was spreading this disease. If it itself was not contagious, it was shadowing something else that was contagious, and that remains some of the mystery today. A group of physicians link it to the 1918 flu. It was obviously the largest flu pandemic in history, and this really went alongside that. And another group of doctors believes it was a reaction to types of bacteria, mainly strep throat. So we're still, even today, trying to figure out what triggered it, what contagious disease was precluding this encephalitis lethargica.
Well, the influenza pandemic clearly claimed many more millions of lives. Is that part of why we've forgotten about encephalitis lethargica? It was simply overshadowed by World War One and the devastation from the flu pandemic.
Yes, that's one of the theories I sort of put forth in the book, is that really this was a decade-long epidemic. So it was not like 1918 when you saw somewhere between 50 and 100 million people with the flu or die of the flu. This was a disease that over 10 years affected about 5 million people worldwide. So comparatively, it was much smaller and definitely overshadowed by the greater world events at the time, including the flu and the war. So I think that certainly contributed to it. Another theory is that we didn't solve this mystery, and medicine doesn't tend to immortalize its failures. We put a lot of, especially in the U.S., a lot of money, research, time, and effort towards solving this mystery, and it remains unsolved.
And it also wasn't declared an epidemic for a few years into it. What was the hesitation? Why did it take so long to be recognized as an epidemic?
I think because they just didn't know what they were dealing with. This is before they had the electron microscope. This is before they're able to identify viruses. Although they knew of them, they knew they existed, that's what the first belief was. This was a new disease. This was some kind of new virus that we would eventually isolate. And not only that, but with the war going on, with not being able to compare cases and research, and with this just vast kaleidoscope of unusual symptoms, every person every brain is different, and therefore every case of this disease was different. Mm. It manifested itself in different ways with every person. So it was probably underdiagnosed for a number of years, and then it just took them a while to realize that this connection that was taking place in other countries, other cities around the world.
Today on the program, we're talking about the mysterious sleeping sickness pandemic of the 1920s. Molly Caldwell Crosby is with us talking about her book, Asleep. And we invite you to join us if you'd like. 801-585-WEST is our number. Or you can send email to radiowest@kuer.org. We need to take a break, but we'll be right back. This is Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce, and today on the program, the medical mystery of a century ago that continues to perplex scientists today. Molly Caldwell Crosby is with us. She's the author of the book Asleep, the Forgotten Epidemic That Remains One of Medicine's Greatest Mysteries. If you've got questions or comments, you can give us a call, 801-585-WEST. That's 801-585-9378, or you can send email to radiowest@kuer.org. You write that this disease may have inspired the tales of Sleeping Beauty and Rip Van Winkle. Even the idea of zombies may have resulted from this real-life disease. Talk about some of the social implications of encephalitis lethargica.
Sure. When Constantine von Economoth, the physician I mentioned that first identified this disease, in 1916, one of the first things he did was go back through medical literature to see if we had actually seen these symptoms before. Not a whole lot existed, but there was basically just stories passed down over a couple of hundred years of something similar to this. They either called it epidemic coma or long spells of sleep or neurological complications to something like flu. And so they had actually recorded a number of these epidemics in history, particularly in Europe. And when you look at when the timing of some of these stories, like Sleeping Beauty, followed a series of these sleeping sickness epidemics in England and in Germany and France, and just same with Edgar Allan Poe's, a couple of his stories, The Premature Burial being one of them, one of the great fears of the time,
sure.
Again, were written shortly thereafter that people were recording these cases of unexplained sleep. So you can imagine how, and Rip Van Winkle, another one, Washington Irving was actually living in London shortly after another epidemic of sleeping sickness. And you can imagine how it would inspire, you know, your imagination with writing these tales of somebody who is asleep for a long spell of time and then wakes up and how has the world changed or things have changed around them.
Yeah, and in some ways, it's nightmarish, you know, to think that you could be existing, but it's kind of a half-life. You're frozen in time.
Yeah, and there was a movement going on, especially in Germany in the 1920s and 30s, kind of this film noir era where they were really fascinated by sleep disorders, mental disorders, which is sort of where the rise of all these zombie films came from, or just different premises where doctors could control their patients through sleep and hypnosis. And the imagination was kind of running wild with this idea.
Hmm. Who got encephalitis lethargica? Predominantly men, women, the young, the old?
It did not home in on any one segment of society. That was one of the things that made it difficult, especially for the epidemiologists to track. In countries, a lot of this book takes place in New York City, where they had one of the worst outbreaks. And the New York public health system was really used to dealing with epidemics based on the demographics, which immigrant neighborhoods it was hitting, which groups of people, which types of people, tenement housing or, different areas of the city. So this was a complete mystery to them. They really could not predict. It made it very hard to track. They knew it was spreading, but they couldn't identify how it was spreading. So this was a whole new deal for them to try to research and follow.
You write about one of the early cases in New York City about a girl named Ruth. What struck you about this case?
I was actually researching with such an unusual number of symptoms and wanting to really convey many different individual cases, because they were so different, you can't really just tell one person's case and explain what this disease was like. I decided to break the book up into case studies and tell these individual stories of seven different individuals, and then the doctors are kind of woven throughout. The doctors were treating a number of these patients, the same doctors. And one of the first patients I ran across with, her name is Ruth, which was the name I gave her. She was given a patient number in the case records. But Dr. Frederick Tilney, who was a very well-known neurologist in New York at the time, he treated some of the first cases of encephalitis lethargica in New York. And I was reading through his case studies and case books. And at the time, their idea of medicine was more holistic than it is today. So most of these doctors kept very extensive personal records on their patients, and they recorded very personal aspects of treating these patients. And so I was really touched in reading his case about Ruth. She was a 16-year-old girl, and he had been called to her house by her parents. She had something like a complaint of arm pain, just, you know, something really innocuous, when it sent her into kind of a violent rage. She was obviously being affected. Personality was being affected, or there was some kind of neurological complication. And he eventually did diagnose this as sleeping sickness. The girl fell into a long sleep, and it went on and on. And he and other physicians there ran all the tests they could. They did everything they could. And finally, he pulled her parents aside and just very quietly said to them, "There's nothing else we can do. She's not going to recover from this." 30% to 40% of these patients were dying if they never came out of the sleep. And when he turned back around and looked at Ruth, tears were running down her face. So it was one of the first documented instances that these patients are aware of what's happening around them. I think for a while that the doctors could and family members could just kind of live with the hope that, well, at least they're not really suffering. They're not aware of what's happening. And Ruth was one of the first documented cases where we knew that was not the case.
Mm. You write that dying of encephalitis lethargica would not prove to be the tragedy. Surviving it would. What was life like for people who eventually woke up?
Well, about, as I mentioned, about a third of the cases were fatal. Another third recovered to a relatively just normal life, which is probably the category my grandmother Virginia would have fallen into. And another third ended up suffering from what they called chronic effects of this disease. It had a real cruel just aspect to it, in that when these patients recovered from the acute phase, when they finally came up out of this deep sleep, the fever, they could feel normal again, and they and their families believed that they had fully recovered. And then sometimes within a few days or weeks, or in some cases as long as 10 years later, they started showing the physical symptoms that became the hallmark of this disease, mainly the extreme Parkinson's. It became so prevalent that, you know, today we really think of Parkinson's as sort of this disease of advancing years, and it became so prevalent in the 1920s and 30s that the average age of onset was 32 years old. So, and that was directly related to this epidemic. These patients that recovered and then started developing Parkinson's in within months or years. And it advanced quickly, and it put most of those patients in that kind of catatonic state in mental health institutions. They were put away in asylums for the rest of their lives, which is where Oliver Sacks found a group of them 40 years later.
There was a particularly tragic tale in your story about Rosie. And Rosie was a child who had a really violent response to her sleeping sickness. Can you describe what happened to her?
It was interesting to me after reading Oliver Sacks' Awakenings and reading some of the early, there were 9,000 articles on this disease written in the 1920s, and reading a lot of the articles about it, the way this disease affected adults and the way it affected children ended up being very surprising to me, and a big difference in how the people recovered from it. For the adults, it really was this Parkinson's physical disability that put them in wheelchairs, put them trapped within their own bodies, and eventually in institutions for the rest of their lives. It was, as I mentioned earlier, it was affecting the basal ganglia in the brain, sort of the message center within the brain. And so that's what was altering the movement, causing the movement disorders with the adults. It was affecting dopamine production. So with the adults, you could really see the outcome of this, the very physical, noticeable outcome. Because children's brains don't really finish growing until they're in their early 20s, They still don't know why, but most of the doctors at the time believed it was still affecting the basal ganglia. It was still affecting the message center, but it was having a greater effect on the messages going to and from the frontal lobe, the part of the brain that controls impulse and emotions. And that ended up being very tragic for the children. Most of these children, 70% of these children, ended up with severe psychological changes and personality disorders. Some became extremely OCD, obsessive compulsive. Several developed Tourette's syndrome, a lot of unusual sort of neurological tics. And an offshoot of this was that several of them became violently insane. Basically, that was the case with Rosie. Several patients, both adults and children, attempted suicide. I think just the mental changes, the psychological changes were too much for them to handle. And in the case of Rosie, hers was almost an extreme form of OCD that became, she displayed self-mutilating behavior. She's definitely one of the more extreme cases in the book. And she was taken to the hospital because she was pulling out her own teeth, even though she was just 14, 15, 16 years old when all this was taking place. And then eventually she pulled out nearly all of her teeth when she was in the hospital. And while she was there, she also pulled out her eyes. So she was a very extreme case of what could happen, the changes that could take place. The doctors believed that she was able to do this because the pain mechanism in her brain had really been altered by the disease. So she wasn't feeling pain when she did this, but obviously it was debilitating. It handicapped her for the rest of her life.
It's interesting. I mean, for extreme behaviors like that, you wouldn't know whether to take them to a neurologist or to a psychoanalyst. And I think that's something that you explore in the book, is just the interweaving of these two fields during this time.
Yeah, that was a really fascinating aspect of the story for me from this time period. The two fields were actually combined. They were known as neuropsychiatry, and it was a different approach to the brain. They considered the brain and the mind to be one entity, and today we really separate those into neurology and psychiatry. We treat the brain and the mind separately. For these patients and for these doctors, it seems very critical that they considered them a combined force, because this was a disease of the brain. It was leaving physical evidence of damage and of swelling behind, but it was completely altering the personalities and the mind of the patients suffering from them, the symptoms of this. So it was really interesting to me to see how doctors approached it differently than they do today. And even in my interview with Dr. Sachs, he said, you know, even today he feels like we do a disservice to the patient when we separate too much neurology from psychiatry, because they are so interrelated. And that definitely proved to be the case with these patients with encephalitis lethargica.
Well, you mentioned that, you know, some of these people did end up in an asylum. It did present this unique problem for public health officials and society in learning how to not only treat, but, you know, contain these individuals so that they didn't hurt others or themselves.
Right. It was a big problem, because by the nature of this disease, the people who survived it, they had chronic debilitating symptoms. They had to go somewhere. The children that were becoming violently ill were attacking family members or trying to kill their parents or running loose on the streets and going after people. They clearly had to be put somewhere where they could be safe from themselves and from others. And then the physical symptoms the adults were suffering, they also ended up chronically ill, living a number of decades longer, but not able to care for themselves. So I think another reason this disease may have been so forgotten was they were out of sight. These patients ended up in institutions about by the 1940s and were not out in public again.
One of the high-profile cases that you write about is Jessie Morgan, the wife of the banker J.P. Morgan. What were the circumstances of Jessie Morgan's case?
That was interesting to me to read more. I did not know much about them. They were a very close, loving couple, very dependent on one another, I think. And Jessie Morgan had been taking care of one of their grandchildren who had a case of the flu. And by about June of 1925, she was sitting in church and came down ill with something. And by the time Jack Morgan got home, she had fallen into this deep sleep, this sleeping sickness. And he called in Fred Tilney, the same doctor who had treated Ruth. And they did diagnose it as sleeping sickness, but they believed it would have a positive outcome. So Jack Morgan returned to work every day on Wall Street. He posted up notices to tell friends and family that she was doing fine, that everything looked good. He had five nurses on full-time staff to puree food and do things like that to keep her alive, because usually in such a deep sleep, a lot of these patients could not even eat or drink. And it was a sad outcome. By August, her heart gave out and she ended up dying, which was very difficult for Jack Morgan. He was apparently distraught after that and decided to donate the money to research this disease and hopefully find a vaccine for it. This was really the height of the vaccine research age. So he funded an entire floor of research at the New York Neurological Institution to try to develop this vaccine and prevent others from suffering the way he and his wife had.
How successful was their work into a vaccine, or at least into some kind of effective treatment?
Unfortunately, not very effective. They had the research, they had the funding, they certainly had the talent in the neurological departments of the various hospitals there and at the institute. It had everything going for it, and the patients certainly had a lot of hope, as well as these doctors, because these patients by then were showing up at the neurological institute with these chronic symptoms coming on. And it was becoming aware for the first time that this disease was really going to have a two-punch to it. They did work on the research for a vaccine throughout the 1930s, as well as different treatments, just all kinds of treatments that they tried. Most were not terribly successful. And then by about the big problem really ended up happening with 1929 and the stock market crash. Sure. They lost a lot of their funding, and they were not able to, the head of the research team, Josephine Neal, who in and of herself is just an interesting story, because this is a woman who's the head of one of the greatest disease research committees going on in the United States at the time period. And this is when, you know, less than 5% of medical students are actually women. So she was just sort of a fascinating story herself. She cut her salary in half. She started selling things she owned. She was holding raffles, everything she could to keep funding up to continue this. They were very hopeful, but they were not able to keep up the funding, and they obviously would not have been able to really ever come to a conclusion with this disease, because even today we're still working on it. With today's medical advancement technology, we still have sporadic cases today, so there are groups of doctors around the world still devoted to trying to solve the mystery of this disease. They're not having any more luck with it than the doctors did in the 1920s or 30s.
And I guess some of the urgency also subsided, because by the 1930s, we weren't seeing the cases in the epidemic proportions that we had, you know, just a few years earlier.
True.
So I suppose that hindered some research as well.
Right. And they needed a lot of those acute cases to really be studying. They didn't realize at the time that it was – they knew it was happening in epidemic proportions. They didn't know it was going to be a finite epidemic. They didn't know that this was going to have an ending to it. And by about 1929, the cases did wind down. And then all they're left with were all of these chronically ill patients, and they were trying to address those symptoms and help those patients treating the chronic symptoms. So that took away from a lot of the active vaccine research as well.
It couldn't have been very easy work because this disease was confused with the flu, polio, depression, schizophrenia, the whole range. And so was there anyone who kind of was looking in one direction instead of looking all of the, you know, the range of possibilities? That must have made it difficult.
It did, and it's interesting to me that so many of the researchers and physicians today are circling the same theories that they were dealing with in the 1920s and 30s, this idea that it's related to the flu, that it could be its own virus, although that one is not really one of the prevailing theories anymore, that it's a reaction to strep. I think one of the things they've pretty well settled on now is that this was an immune response to something. Just like if you hit your knee against a table, your knee is going to start to swell. In this case, something is triggering an immune response inside the brain that causes the swelling. And it's that swelling that does the long-term damage as well as the acute damage, the sleeping. So the mystery remains kind of what that trigger is, or why are certain people overreacting to something, a virus or a bacteria, in a way that's so much more pronounced than other people.
We're talking about a long-forgotten disease that immobilized patients' bodies while their minds remained completely aware of what was going on around them. Molly Caldwell-Crosby is with us. She researched the epidemic. Her findings are in the book Asleep, the forgotten epidemic that remains one of medicine's greatest mysteries. 801-585-WEST is our phone number, or you can send email to radiowest@kuer.org. We need to take another break, but we'll be right back. This is Radio West on KUER and SiriusXM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. In this hour, what do we know about sleeping sickness, an epidemic that claimed over a million lives, and could it come back? Molly Caldwell-Crosby is with us, author of Asleep, the Forgotten Epidemic That Remains One of Medicine's Greatest Mysteries. You can join us at 801-585-WEST or email us at radiowest@kuer.org. Molly Crosby, you mentioned in the book that frontal lobotomies gained some popularity during the middle century, last century. Was this a common treatment for sleeping sickness survivors, and did it work?
I was interested. I tried to research and look into some of those more famous frontal lobotomy cases. They often were for schizophrenia, and schizophrenia was sometimes sleeping sickness manifest itself. Its chronic symptoms did as schizophrenia. So I was interested to see. I did not see that frontal lobotomies were used very often as a treatment for sleeping sickness, in large part because they were really coming around after the fact, long after this epidemic. But it was interesting to see what the physicians of the time period felt. One of them, S.E. Jalief, he is a neuropsychiatrist working in New York, and he's one of the prominent doctors in this book, and who dealt with a number of these patients. He was definitely he was more on the psychiatry end of it, psychoanalysis in particular. He was a friend of Freud's, so he was a little bit outside of the neurology circles. And a lot of his patients, he was treating their psychological problems from sleeping sickness. And he later wrote about frontal lobotomies. He went to hear a medical conference on them, and he said, you know, it's undoing all the work that we've done. It's like trying to roast the pig by burning down the house. he was particularly bothered by the fact that it did permanent damage to the parts of the brain that he was trying to heal.
Let's go to the phones. 801-585-WEST. Molly Caldwell-Crosby is with us talking about her book, Asleep. And Jimmy is joining us from Salt Lake City. Jimmy, welcome.
Thank you. I just had a question. Did anyone investigate whether it was related to the changes in diet with people and also the fact that there were all these new soft drinks coming out, things like that, uses of new vitamins, different people selling different concoctions? There was a lot of nose candy during that whole time, people snorting the cocaine, and only nobody knows what they were really cutting the cocaine with, things like that during that whole time of the, you know, from the late 1890s through the 20s. And then a lot of that became, all that stuff became illegal and changed. People were putting, squeezing lime into Coca-Cola to activate the coca leaf extract, and then people using different vitamins, and maybe even mononucleosis disease, which caused a lot of fatigue. You know, I wonder if there was any dietary influence on that they investigated.
I didn't run across a lot of research regarding diets, although being as holistic as they were, they definitely considered that as part of the whole picture. But one idea that I mentioned in the book is that the 1920s in particular, so much is changing in people's lives with the advent of vaccines. All of a sudden, people are being treated with antitoxins, vaccines, in addition to all of the normal epidemics and diseases that are circulating in large cities at the time. It's possible that we were just overwhelming people's immune systems, and diet could have been a part of that as well. If you overwhelm someone's immune system to that point, they can start reacting to things they shouldn't, and that seems to be what was happening with encephalitis lethargica. It was causing the body's own immune system to start attacking brain cells.
I know there's another disease where you lose all your hair, and there's different immune things like that where it attacks itself, and you lose all the hair on your body and things like that. So there are diseases like that, and this one particularly affects the brain. That's a mystery, yes.
Yeah. Jimmy, thanks so much for the call. 801-585 West is our number. You note in the book that the last known survivor of sleeping sickness, of this epidemic in the 1920s, died in 2002, and that his sister donated his brain to science. I'm wondering, did his brain teach us anything about encephalitis lethargica?
Yeah, his name was Philip. He was he's the last case study in the book, and he actually came down with this disease when he was 12. His parents had to put him into an institution, and he died there 7 decades later. Mm. He's believed to be the last known living survivor from this epidemic, and they did not conclusively find anything from studying his brain. They've also had access in London to archived brain tissue from 1918, both flu patients and sleeping sickness patients, because they were trying to find if there was a link really between the two. But obviously, tissue that old, it's going to be hard to work with. And I was talking to a group of doctors actually here in Memphis at St. Jude who are doing some research on the connection between flu and encephalitis lethargica. And, you know, they said really the chances of that surviving that amount of time, being able to find still evidence after that many decades is fairly slim anyway. But they explained it as it may possibly have been something like a hit-and-run damage to the brain, that basically this very virulent case of flu that the world had never seen before that hit in 1918 with such a high mortality rate, the body, you know, just wasn't equipped to handle that. A lot of these patients had flu and sleeping sickness, which could just be coincidence or it could be related. And it's possible that, you know, an overwhelmed immune system seeing this virulent form of flu for the first time was overreacting and causing this brain swelling. And what they refer to as the hit and run aspect is that the flu could have caused the neurological complications and then hit and run and disappeared. And so there would not be evidence in brain tissue today or then that would show the long-term effects of that.
Hmm. 801-585 West is our number. We'll go to Lars calling from Provo, Utah. Lars, welcome.
Thank you. This puts me in mind of something that happened while I'm a psychologist, and I was working in a hospital in California. And in the early 80s, there was a designer drug, a drug that was made to be used to help people get high before it could be found and made illegal. It's now illegal. That put people into a locked-in syndrome. And so chemists were trying to make these drugs that would make people high. And a few unfortunate individuals took this drug, and it very severely damaged their basal ganglia in the same way that this encephalitis did. And they were left locked in. And L-DOPA didn't help them at all, or help them just a little bit. And they were sort of aware, but couldn't move.
One of the sad ironies that I mentioned in the book is that when they came up with sort of the chemical lobotomies, when they started introducing Thorazine and things, the drugs of that nature, to treat the mentally ill, it had the exact same effect on the brain that sleeping sickness did. It caused some physical disabilities. It sometimes caused Parkinson's. And then it caused this stupor, this inactive, almost catatonic state that kept the patient so still. So how frustrating for these physicians who had been spending decades trying to solve this mystery to see these new psychotropic drugs come out that basically voluntarily put patients in that same condition by damaging the basal ganglia.
Lars, you mentioned that you're a psychologist. I have a question for you. Did you learn about encephalitis lethargica in medical school?
Well, I'm a psychologist.
Psychologist, excuse me.
Yes, I did learn about it because I took classes on neuropsychology. And so neuropsychology is an attempt to assess brain damage as it is associated with psychological kinds of skills or deficits. And so you might think of it as a finer-grained approach to understanding performance and cognition than what a neurologist would do. A neurologist is looking for grosser kinds of problems. The neuropsychologist tries to assess more fine-grained kinds of things like learning disabilities that might arise or speaking difficulties that are subtle that might arise from brain damage. And so we studied I think it was, there was also something called St. Louis encephalopathy, And that was a little later, but we studied some of those things,
Lars, thanks very much for the call. Molly Crosby, in your book, you noted that by 1960, this disease was no longer taught in medical school. So Lars clearly has heard of it, but do medical students today learn about this kind of obscure disease?
They certainly learn, like if you're in neurology, they still learn about von Economo based on his sleep research. And so usually this is brought up in the context of von Economo's encephalitis. It's interesting he brought up the St. Louis encephalitis, which I believe is spread by a mosquito. This, one of the mysteries about this type of encephalitis is usually when we see those diseases, it's spread by an insect. There's a sleeping sickness, an African sleeping sickness, that is spread actually by the tsetse fly. There's the Japanese encephalitis, there's St. Louis encephalitis, there's different types of these similar symptoms, but they're always spread by a vector. So that's another mystery sort of surrounding this one. This is one of the few cases of just an unexplained encephalitis that spreads.
Lars, thanks for the call. 801-585-WEST is our number. This email from Brian in Orem, Utah, he says, great topic. Molly Crosby says that these people were not comatose and not unconscious. Does she have any additional stories about what these people were aware of or could recall when they woke up? Molly Crosby?
Yeah, there were actually some interesting cases in Oliver Sacks' book, Awakenings, where in one case, the woman still believed she was in the 1920s, even though this was 40 years later, and she still sort of used the slang from the 1920s and made references to pop culture from that time period. Other patients, however, were completely aware of what year it was, who the president was, you know, general things that had changed. So, again, it really affected everyone differently, but there were some just sort of interesting stories from people who years or decades later had been either in that sleep state or the trapped within their own body state, aware of what was happening around them. And one of the really fascinating things to me that took place in the 1920s with some of these physicians, as well as in Dr. Sacks' case studies in Awakenings, was that personal details of a person's life could have an effect on them. A lot of these patients that were physically disabled years following their sleeping sickness could stand up or move if a certain piece of music was played. And likewise, during the acute stage of the sleeping sickness, when people had been in the 1920s, were asleep for weeks at a time, you could play a certain violin piece and they might wake up. It really had an unusual effect on the brain, and personality certainly played a role in that.
As we discussed earlier in the program, the disease, you know, was the subject of Oliver Sacks' book, a movie inspired by the book. Do you think that this disease will stay in the public eye, or will it fade again into history?
I think it will end up probably being considered more of a disorder, syndrome, an autoimmune problem. That I'm not sure if we will find one specific thing that triggers it, like a virus or bacteria, or if this is something that certain people are susceptible to. There's a lot of research that just sort of goes on. MS was another disease at that time period that they were researching for sort of similar clues. Why are some people more susceptible to something than someone else? Why would a virus trigger a certain immune response in one person that has debilitating effects and not in another? So I think that's more of the direction that this disease research will go in.
Is there a breakthrough in sight, though, do you think? Do you think that this is something that can be solved because it's got such a range?
Right. If it does not have one single trigger, if they don't find one exact trigger to it, like the flu virus or strep, this is very closely related to a condition called PANDAS that is sort of a pediatric autoimmune following strep disorder that occurs in children, that one of the neurologists I interviewed today is working on. He sees cases of both PANDAS and sleeping sickness in children today. He believes very much that it's being triggered by bacteria. So it will be interesting to see if they can find one single cause like the flu virus or like a reaction to bacteria, or if this will just sort of be put aside as a autoimmune disorder that some people are susceptible to. If that's the case, I think it will always remain something of a mystery.
But it's that epidemic component that
that's frightening and mysterious.
It is frightening and mysterious. And is there any significant headway in answering that question? Why in the 20s, why did it spread?
Well, some of the most interesting recent research was done by this same group of doctors at St. Jude that I referred to. And they were looking at very virulent forms of the flu, particularly bird flu, which is what in 1918 was so deadly and tends to be very virulent and difficult for humans to react to and to survive. And they've been taking cases of H5N1 from Asia that circulates and is an avian flu. And when they inject that virus into animal models, they see similar reactions to encephalitis lethargica. They see Parkinson's, some physical disabilities, sleep or coma-like states. So they're really on that track that they think it's an extremely virulent flu, not just your average yearly flu or not even swine flu that would be triggering this. That's the most significant research I've seen come out, and that's even been just within the last year.
Hmm. Only got about a minute left, but Molly Crosby, I'm wondering why you wrote this book. What are you hoping that readers will take away?
Well, as you mentioned before, my first book was actually about yellow fever, and this being sleeping sickness, I get asked a lot why I choose to write about disease. And I never actually consider it that I write about disease. I consider that I write stories about people, and that these diseases, these epidemics, were tragic to people, to families, you know, individual lives, as well as cities and places as a whole who had to deal with large outbreaks of these disease, and how individuals and how communities handled it. And so to me, that's the more personal aspect of the story, and then certainly the connection with my grandmother with the sleeping sickness case. But so,
Molly Caldwell Crosby, she's a science writer and author of the book Asleep, the Forgotten Epidemic That Remains One of Medicine's Greatest Mysteries. Molly Crosby, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. The show is directed by Mike Anderson, produced by Elaine Clark. The executive producer is Doug Fabrizio, and I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Thank you.